Загальна мобілізація, всі на те.
Ми зможемо змінити владу. Мы сможем разработать изменения. Мы
подписание договора по вхождению Республики Крым и города Севастополь в Российскую Федерацию.
Не Россия! Донбасс, Крым, Россия!
Обстрілы террористов вкотре спробовали взяти Донецкий аэропорт.
Донецкая Народная Республика по результатам референдума
Донецкой и Луганской областей предпочитает...
Очевидно, что существенное ослабление курса рубля...
Ускорение инфляции связано как с действием внешторговых
ограничений... Как следствие с ослаблением курса национальной валюты.
A revolution, an annexation, a war, and now a looming financial crisis. From the Euromaidan to the seizure of Crimea to the conflict in Donbass, 2014 has been a momentous and highly consequential year. And with the conflict in eastern Ukraine unresolved, and Russia headed for a recession, and the air thick with political uncertainty, 2015 promises to be just as eventful. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to our year-end edition of the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, how are you?
And also joining us via Skype from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Well, you can say that if 2012 was the year of protest and 2013 was the year of backlash and 2014 was the year of empire, what do we expect 2015 to be, Mark? What are we headed for here?
Well, I think it's going to be messy. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be confrontational. But much like Pandora's box, I ultimately think it's also going to be a hopeful year in some ways. I mean, if I can just unpack those. Messy in that I think it's going to be very hard to really see some clear line. I think, and this is something we can talk about, we are seeing the Kremlin increasingly uncertain as to what to do. I mean, for example, you know, over corruption, there was all kind of clear flip-floppings. Mm-hmm. There were sort of suggestions that there was going to be something in the big speech, and then there was nothing. And then there's people like Ivanov now saying we need to have a crackdown. You know, clear signs of disputes taking place behind the curtain, under the carpet, behind the closed doors, whichever sort of metaphor you want to use. And I think that's going to continue. I don't think there's going to be some kind of grand strategy emerging. So it's going to be one of lots of ad hoc measures. Difficult, clearly, economically, politically, in terms of geopolitics. We've got the World Bank already saying that basically it's going to be a 0.7% contraction in the Russian economy next year, which might actually prove to be faintly optimistic. We have inflation sort of running way ahead.
Rubles lost 8% this week alone.
Absolutely, and despite the fact that they're sort of pumping money in and trying all kinds of measures, including sort of basically offering to launder your capital, no questions asked. Politically difficult, precisely in that, on the one hand, there are clear disputes, but one of the sort of factors of the Putin regime is that it has made it almost impossible to have, as it were, legitimate channels for expressing those disagreements. So it all has to be behind the scenes, aesopian, carried out in terms of power struggles and so forth. There is no clear forum in which actually people can say, well, here is an alternative idea. So again, I think it's going to be sort of politically complex in that respect. And geopolitically, well, almost that goes without saying, given the new hot piece, Cold War II, call it what you will, that has emerged. Confrontational. Well, again, I mean, in part, that's obviously with the West. There's no way, unfortunately, that I can see an imminent end to the Ukrainian venture and all the sort of the fallout from that, but actually also confrontational with the Russian people. And in this respect, I mean, if I can just sort of follow on from Kirill's very nice point from the last podcast, which is Putin is disappointed with the world, I also get the sense that Putin is disappointed with the Russian people. They are failing to show the kind of resolution and purpose that an imperial people ought. And therefore, I think we're going to see that kind of, again, pressures that can't be visibly manifest without creating a disproportionate backlash. But it was quite interesting seeing the most recent polls that were showing support for troops in Ukraine, or for the deployment of troops in Ukraine, falling from 74% to 23%. I mean, that's a pretty dramatic tumble. Right. So this is it. Or even if, let's say, people are not yet willing to say, "I'm fed up with Putin," they are increasingly willing to say, "I am fed up with a whole variety of specific policy issues, which just happen to be Putin." Mm. Related. So this is why I also think it's actually in some ways going to be a hopeful year, at least for those of us who want to see Russia sort of develop not actually as a great power empire, but instead as a working, stable democracy. Because precisely I think it's going to be the year, because of all these pressures, that actually we begin to see those cracks and fissures that we've been talking about for a long time.
3 years.
Really beginning to open. Again, I think it's taken a combination of reckless foreign adventure, time, and oil price to really do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was, I don't know if any of you have seen the zenrus.ru website. It's invaluable. I put it up there on Twitter. It has, in real time, the ruble-dollar rate, the ruble-euro rate, and the price of Brent crude. In real time with Zen music and like soothing, a soothing video loop of your choice of space, mountain, sea, whatever your taste is. I have it up at all times now because it's a great resource because I can just go there and see all of it right there and listen to kind of cool music.
And yet chill out exactly.
And chill out at the same time. Yeah. The funny thing is the ruble dollar rate and oil are beginning to converge around 60. Because the ruble dollar rate, so it's above 57 now. And the last time I checked Brent crude, it was in 63 and low percentage points, heading under 63. So it's I'm expecting them to converge around 60 pretty soon. Kirill, what are your thoughts? What do you think 2015 will be the year of, if this was the year of empire?
Speaking frankly, I don't know, because I think that everything, just almost everything, could happen next year. For instance, I cannot exclude the possibility that Putin and some of his aides, they decided, or they will decide, to reinvent so-called liberal Putin, to change the government, to replace Medvedev and especially Medinsky and so on. Extremely unpopular, even among the supporters of Putin, you know, mild supporters of Putin, by, say, Kudrin and so on, and try to pretend that nothing happened. Nothing happened. And
this is something I want to get into. Is this possible? Can Putin reinvent himself at some point? Because there's a series of questions I have about this year, and that's, you've just hit on one of the questions.
I think such attempt is possible. I am absolutely sure that it will be unsuccessful. Absolutely. It will fail. But anyway, it's not just, you know, a possibility. There are some people among so-called liberals, which are inside or near Kremlin circle, who are ready to play this game. For instance, Kudrin himself. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that he is still into this game, and he still has some hopes for such turn. Another possibility, as sort of Gonza economists predict, like Slava Rabinovich and Demura and, you know, a lot of other people, that there will be, you know, an imminent crash in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, and that's all. And, you know, Russian economy will be over, and Russia as a state will be over, and so on. I don't believe in this, but we can't exclude this possibility, having in mind what happened in 1991. Mm-hmm. Third version of the future for Russia and Putin himself is a slow decline next year. Mm-hmm. I think it's the most real.
Yeah,
the most obvious version. And another one, it's a sort of mass, you know, protests and discontent and so on. But the question is, what sort of? So I absolutely agree with the Mark that, of course, a lot of, you know, people in Russia, they are just fed up with all the situation, but they cannot connect the situation directly to Putin. So I don't know actually why they cannot connect. So I don't believe in, 100% influence of state propaganda and TV and so on. Something more interesting and deep is happening there in the public mind of Russian society. But anyway, we are not, going to analyze the situation. But anyway, these protests could be against their recent situation.
Right.
Let's put it in this term.
Well, I wanted to zero in on, I have, right now I have four big questions going into the coming year. You all may want to add some questions to this, but I have four big questions on this. And the first one is, what effect will a shrinking economic pie have on the elite? Because that's what we're ultimately talking about here, is that as the economy contracts, as sanctions set in, as the ruble continues to fall, as oil prices continue to fall, most importantly, there's just not going to be as much goodies to pass around. I want to quote from a piece Masha Gessen, the Putin biographer Masha Gessen, author of The Man Without a Face, wrote in an op-ed in the New York Times this week, because I think this is an interesting take, and it's a good kind of launch point for this part of the discussion. Quote, imagine a large number of spiders all living in a single web. As the economy takes a dive, they are compelled simply to hold on for dear life. As the web begins to shrink, they can kick off some of their weaker comrades, as has already happened with two major Russian entrepreneurs whose companies were taken away from them by men richer and more powerful than they. Meanwhile, Mr. Putin, who still sits at the middle of the intricate system he has woven over the course of 15 years, faces no such risk. Mark, is Masha Gessen right here? Or, I mean, do you agree with that assessment of how a shrinking economic pie will affect the elite right now?
Well, I mean, putting aside the slightly unfortunate sort of spiders parallel, as well as the mixing of metaphors, we have diving and shrinking webs. Yes, of course, there is the inevitability that as the pie shrinks, then people want to compete or need to compete just to kind of hold on to the size of slice they've got. And for them to hold on to the slice they've got, then other people will have to have disproportionately small slivers. I mean, that's already visible. I mean, that was part of, you know, probably a substantial part of the motivation behind the whole Yevtushenko case. It was both political, but also it was about, you know, wanting to carve up Sistema and its assets. So, yeah, that's going to happen. I think I'd want to make three quick points, though. One is that, firstly, I would flatly disagree that Putin faces no such risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her notion that actually Putin is entirely safe is something I would challenge, and I know we're going to come to talking more about Putin himself, but the idea that the web can shrink and fall and will do all these other things without any trouble to the big spider in the middle is wrong. Secondly, though, we also have to realize the extent to which when we talk about the elite, we're not just talking about the oligarchs. I mean, it's easy to focus on the oligarchs, but let's also bear in mind that...
And I would add that was Masha's piece was about the myth of the oligarchs and that there are no real oligarchs, that Putin's got them all kind of on a rope now and there's no such
thing. Yeah, but still, even the people she's talking about, I mean, whether we call them oligarchs or pseudo-garchs or whatever... But actually, you know, the overwhelming members of what we think of as the elite are merely sort of upper members of the certain sort of upper class, the budgetniki. Everyone is a state employee in one way or another these days, precisely because all the oligarchs, whether they work in fully private sector or semi-private sector, actually do so on the tolerance of the state. So actually, like it or not, directly or indirectly, you know, this is a state economy. And therefore, everything is going to be determined precisely by state decisions. And so this brings on to the third point, which is actually to say, yes, we will see increasing competition. The thing is, this is both a strength and a weakness, or an opportunity and a risk, shall we say, for Putin. There is the opportunity that precisely it therefore becomes something that means that the elite are busy clawing at each other. And that allows Putin to maintain his position precisely as the great decider, going back to one of those roles, mm-hmm. which in many ways was the heart of, and it's always dangerous to use this parallel, Stalin's power, to actually keep the elite divided and constantly appealing to the Vojvod.
Right.
So that's the opportunity for Putin, but the risk is precisely that, in fact, the system begins to become unmanageable because it's so riven by these tensions and disagreements and disputes within the elite as they try to hold on to what they've got, that in effect, actually, the struggle becomes more important than governance. And we've sort of seen this in the past. I mean, this is one of the things that happened with the Silovik Wars, that there are points when Putin had to step in, although he was glad to see one spook agency or one spook sort of figure clawing at another because it kept them sort of busy and off balance. But then he suddenly realized, oh my gosh, it actually is impinging on the operational capacities of these agencies to actually do their job. Well, we might see that happening with the whole elite, that its ability to actually manage Russia becomes imperiled by the sort of disputes that we're going to be seeing over resources. Mm.
Kirill, what do you think? Is Putin immune? I mean, how, first, the broader question, I mean, what effect will the shrinking economic pie have on the elite? And would you agree with Masha Gessen's assessment here that the Putin has pretty much made himself immune to any?
First of all, I strongly disagree with Masha Gessen's piece, with her usage of organicist or zoological metaphors describing society and politics and so on. It's a grave mistake, actually, because it's a very special area of, you know, of the world, you know, people and their deeds and, you know, politics and so on. Never apply such metaphors to
this
politics.
Is just one passage from one, yes, very large piece. I thought the most compelling passage in the piece, but it was
secondly, I think that Putin now is in a quite, you know, serious danger. Not just because of, you know, this new disappointment of elite, you know. Just imagine how their life conditions of the, you know, decent minigarch or oligarch changed dramatically for the last year. You know, just imagine, you know, some vice governor of, you know, say, Tambov region and so on, who lived his life very, you know, happily, who sent his children to Great Britain, to, you know, to English schools and universities, who spent, you know, his holidays in Milan, and now he is absolutely locked inside the country, which is not a very good solution for him, because most of this elite, they can, you know, claim, they could claim that they're, you know, they're patriots and so on, but speaking frankly, they're afraid of this country, this elite, and they are not very happy with this country, and they don't want to leave, spend money, spend time, and so on, grow their children in this country. That's the most interesting and important thing, speaking about this elite. Just, you know, one example, you know, it's the last, you know, little scandal 2 days or 1 day ago when Dmitry Peskov's wife posted on Instagram how she is spending her holidays in Paris, buying the, you know, foie gras and so on, and how wonderful French food is, and, you know, wine and life in Paris and so on. That is a very interesting example of still of this schizophrenia of Russian elite. And moreover, I think in the list of Putin's failures, I think it's a very long list of Putin's failures of 2014, you know, beginning from Ukraine to, you know, economy and so on. It's a failure to build a new national elite. Do you remember all this?
Well, he was starting to do that. He brought all all these people in from the provinces. He is constructing a new elite right now.
Yes, but to
they're in the middle level. I mean, it's the process is just beginning. I wrote about this a couple month or so ago. The Putin's class of 2014, of course, alluding to the class of 1937, which I got a bunch of hell for allegedly comparing Putin to Stalin. But I was just comparing the tactic. But it was bringing in young people from the provinces who were pretty malleable. You could the quote from the piece was you could download any ideological software in their brains you chose. They were vetted for loyalty to Putin, and they're being placed throughout the mid-levels of the elite right now. And this is kind of Putin's little bureaucratic army. I don't know how.
Insert one footnote just before we get back to Kirill. I mean, the thing about the as it were the class of 1937 parallel is it's interesting, but that only worked because of the massively carnivorous nature of the Stalinist system. You can do that when basically you're murdering all your senior figures, because then precisely you have this massive turnover. Otherwise, you have to wait for it to happen organically.
Right.
This will be fine if Putin wasn't going to be there for another 10 years. But we're not talking that. Anyway, sorry.
Well, maybe he's thinking that way.
That was what I was going to say. That, of course, it's all these things are, you know, wonderful and so on. This 24, 27 guys who are, you know, comparing Putin to Stalin and so on. But it's a very long way to go for these young people. And Putin deals with his own elite, which is, you know, surrounding him. He tried to change the very attitude of the existing elite. Not to kill them, not to extinct this part of the elite and so on, to change their mind, and he failed. And that is very dangerous for him. And if we're still, you know, discussing the various possibilities and so on and prognosis on 2015, I would bet on coup d'etat, not on, you know, mass
right.
protests.
No,
not,
I think that's the consensus. If change is going to come, that's how it's going to come.
So not much, you know, maybe one American dollar. Next year it will be something about 300 rubles. But anyway, I could bet on this.
Mm. Well, let's move to society now and talk about what effect do you think the shrinking economic pie will have on society? Because you have to wonder. I mean, people once traded their freedom for prosperity, and now they're being asked to trade their prosperity for patriotism, the motherland, empire, what have you, because that's what's going to happen. They're trading their prosperity. It's going to take a little while, but this is going to hit ordinary people. It already is hitting ordinary people. As the ruble falls, it's hitting them as we speak, but it will begin to hit them harder and harder over the year. What effect will this shrinking economic pie have on mass society, Mark? What do you think?
Well, in so many ways, I mean, what we're seeing is a reprise of late Brezhnevism, in that on the one hand, I think precisely people are going to feel that the social contract with them has been broken, and they're right. I mean, that was the essence of the Putin-era social contract, is you stay out of politics. You know, you vote the way you're meant to vote, and you apply the appropriate bumper sticker on your car, but in return for which, life will be better. And will continue to get better. And it's absolutely true that for most Russians, life has been better under Putin than it has at any point in living memory. And that's now clearly changing and will continue to change. And if this were just a blip, that would be one thing. But it is clear that 2015 will be harder than late 2014. And there's no particular guarantee that 2016 is necessarily going to be better. Yeah, I agree with Kirill. I don't think there's going to be some massive and catastrophic crash in the economy. And if nothing else, the Russian state still has, I mean, although it's been burning through quite a bit, you know, there's still money around. There are still reserves that can be put into sort of forestalling that. But still, we're going to see instead a slide downwards. And already we're seeing it actually in the areas, which again is exactly that has happened in under the late Soviet Union, of spend on healthcare, on education, on infrastructure, all these kind of things that attempting for a government, because they don't actually lead to an immediate catastrophic collapse. You don't necessarily notice the next day that there's been less money spent on the hospital. But on the other hand, it actually does slowly seep through and mean things are dirtier and slower and there's not as many ambulance crews and whatever else. And after a certain point, people begin to become reluctant to feel that they need to play their part with a social contract. But what I don't yet know is whether or not that will actually lead to any kind of overt split with the regime. You know, we may see a kind of a renewal of the kind of Bolotnaya movement and so forth. But there aren't yet political parties which in any meaningful sense represent an opposition. There aren't yet really structures to do so. And then any structures that will emerge are probably going to be really quite local and quite specific.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned hospitals, Mark, because the most significant protest that's happened in Moscow in recent months has been a protest of healthcare workers protesting the consolidation of Moscow's hospitals, which is essentially cutting their budgets and consolidating. We may see a lot of these little single issue protests that could conceivably coalesce into a mass movement, no?
Well, they could, and that was, in a way, the big sort of hope or wonder about the earlier Bolotnaya, Navalny and so forth protests, but it didn't happen then. Mm-hmm. It could happen, but the trouble is, who does it and on what basis? I mean, you can't really have a sort of a movement that is based on the spend more money on things ideology. There has to be something a little bit more comprehensive, a little bit or more sort of overarching. Now, corruption promised to potentially offer that. But in some ways, the issue now is less about corruption, which was, as it were, corruption was, we know there's lots of money, but it's being stolen and not spent. Now it's going to be much more, well, yes, there's a bit of that, but it's also, we know there's less money. I said, people are going to actually have to find some kind of ideology if they are going to have an overarching movement.
One thing is that the military budget's increasing even as the overall overall budget revenues decrease. That's happening. You were talking about amnesties for people bringing their capital back from abroad. We're still getting juicy state contracts dished out to Putin cronies. I mean, so there's less money, but there's money, and there's less of it for some, but there's just as much of it for others. And could that become a galvanizing?
Well, so, I mean, these are all things that to be blunt, piss people off. Absolutely. But they don't, I would suggest, still provide the kind of a basis for some kind of movement that can unite, you know, the annoyed healthcare worker, the person who's worried about whether their granny is going to be able to get into hospital, someone who actually has a sort of a wider complaint about the fact that they don't get to travel, or that their sort of spare parts for their imported car are now more expensive, to whatever. There needs to be something more than just simply I'm annoyed. I'm annoyed gets people, as it were, joining existing movements, perhaps, or being willing to join a protest. It also just gets people turned off, less willing to be mobilized by the state. And we've got to realize this is still much, you know, a mobilization state.
And it's a mobilization state, which is pretty important.
So you might say, yeah, but what, again, what does that actually do? So it tries to mobilize people and they don't. They don't come out in protests in support of the regime. That's a bit embarrassing. That actually begins to undercut the legitimacy of the state. But it's a really long-term debilitating process. It's not something that actually can lead, you know, this idea of a liberal coup. Well, that really depends on some kind of sort of clear and present danger to the elite. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm just saying that if it happens, it's going to have to be a new addition to the mix. Mm-hmm. Now, as we saw with the Solidarity movement in Poland, it's actually astonishing how quickly a whole variety of dissatisfactions and protests that are, as it were, held in suspension in society can so quickly crystallize when the right catalyst is added.
That was because,
but that's the thing. Yeah.
In communist Poland, you had the Roman Catholic Church was this large unifying factor. You almost had an alternative civil society operating in communist Poland. There was official life, and then there was real life, and that real life was ready to flip the switch, as you put it. But you had this unifying thing. You had the Roman Catholic Church. You had the charismatic figure of John Paul II, and then you had that link up with the labor movement of Lech Walesa and Solidarity, and then it was already made. Like you said, it just needed a catalyst. I see nothing in Russia of the sort.
Well, this is exactly my point. I can see lots of dissatisfactions, but I don't see anything that actually can precisely lock those together at this point, and particularly, you know, given that the sort of state does still have this stranglehold on TV media, which is still where most people get their news. So, I mean, I think at this point, I mean, I think we're going to see a lot of dissatisfaction, which is going to lead to all kind of just people being turned off, people not being willing to be mobilized, people not being willing to sort of be the enthusiastic supporters. Mm-hmm. But we're not yet seeing the shift from I'm not happy with how things are going to I believe things can be changed and things will be changed.
Right. Now, the other question to look at, too, is now we all seem to agree that as if there is any kind of change in the elite, it's going to happen because of a palace coup type of situation rather than a popular uprising. But what if the former uses the latter? I mean, the latter can be something that's mobilized and used to facilitate that, if it comes to that. I mean, do you see any synergy between discontent in the elite and discontent in the population?
I would say the synergy will be not an active one. I think the idea that anyone within the elite would actively encourage or try to use popular movements again, I think that will be really going to the nuclear option.
Right.
And to be honest, you know, even if I was a disgruntled member of the elite, if I felt that someone else was actually stirring up or in any way sanctioning public protest, I would think this guy is a risk to us all, and right. I need to get my knife between his ribs as quickly as possible.
Right.
I think it's more that if we do begin to see public protests, as I think we will, it begins to kind of provide that impetus within the elite to thinking that we need to do something now while it is still fragmented. I mean, again, we can play the historical parallels. To me, one of the most fascinating ones was the Novocherkassk uprising back in the 50s, which was an entirely local situation. It just happened to be on the one day that they announced a cut in local piece rate norms, i.e. wages basically in the local factory, they announced food price rises. And that led to protests, which when the police refused to actually disperse them, catalyzed more, and in due course they had to send in security troops and people died and such like. That was entirely controllable by the state. But on the other hand, it was this really worrying sound, because Novocherkassk was any town USSR.
It was a mono-city, yeah.
There was a sense of, well, if it could happen there, it could happen anywhere. So we need to be worrying about this. So I think this is it. It's actually going to be public protests, even if they're fragmentary, local, and issue-related, will just create an environment in which actually more and more people in the elite are thinking, we need to do something. We can't just simply hope that this lot will go away, because we need to do something to forestall it before you end up with some new figure, some kind of Navalny love child Udaltsov, who can bring together sort of social media savvy with some kind of, you know, ideological sharp edge, and who might be able to unite them. We need to be ahead of that particular worrying curve.
Kirill, what do you see happening in mass society and in the broader public as the economy worsens?
I think that the absence of real politics and real political parties and real political landscape, in some sense, public political landscape in recent Russia is a very strong point for Putin, and at the same time the weakest point of him. Mm. The strong point because, as Mark said, that there is no some sort of party which, or, you know, leaders who could organize, you know, protests and put them in the right place at the right time, and so to provide them with the right slogans and so on. Of course, that's true. And I think all these efforts to just to nullify the very existence or the very meaning of political life in Russia is the result of a sort of Soviet political mythology. And because don't forget that Putin and his closest aides, they are still from Soviet era, and all of them, they read Soviet textbooks on history about Lenin and his party, and a party which is organizer of the, you know, working class protests and revolution and so on. And they are still afraid of this sort of the political party. And of course, they succeeded in this. Now, what we see, if we can describe somehow political landscape in Russia, it's a desert, just a desert, and that's all. But the weakest point is because there are no any legal ways of protesting now, no more in Russia. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely no. And you know, any smallest protests, you know, the local, about whatever, you know, about local...
Although they allowed those healthcare workers to protest. They allowed that. Moscow allowed that.
Yes, but that was just one case, just to show that we can allow them. But just imagine somewhere in Kemerovo or in Vladivostok, they don't allow them to do these things, and so on. And that is the situation like, you know, a minefield. So no one knows where, you know, the real blast will happen, and why it will happen. It could happen because of the prices. It could happen because of the conflict around, you know, local cinema, whatever, absolutely whatever. And two more interesting things, the previous things which I was speaking just obvious. First of all, is about the very interesting comparison which Mark said about Novocherkassk events. In Soviet times, so-called, you know, трудящиеся, you know, like population, all population of Soviet Union, they have a you know, a real possibility to ask someone to do something with their life. That was Soviet trade unions. There were, you know, Communist Party with the local organization, and you can, you know, just ask some local party boss to do this and this and this, and sometimes you could succeed. Don't forget about, you know, such industry like you know, industry in commas, like you know, letters to editors of Pravda and Izvestia and so on. There was a sort of you know, a system. And this system worked for, you know, several decades.
It's a feedback loop. It's what a political science would call a feedback loop.
In some sense. And now, you know, the elite and the authorities, they are absolutely out of reach.
There's no feedback loop now.
Yes, absolutely. And that is a very dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. And another one point is that when we speak about, you know, future or possible protests in 2015 in Russia, don't forget that that could be a protest of an absolutely, you know, different form which everyone is expected. Mm-hmm. It's not so everything is thinking about, you know, new Maidan,
right?
But it could be no, just in different form, and no one knows which form it could be. So, as you know, this famous proverb says about, you know, French army in 20th century, they are preparing for the, you know, for the previous war.
Right, right. Well, on the last two things, the last two questions I had coming into this, as this year winds up, coming into the next, are related to Mr. Putin himself, of course. And the first, Kirill, you alluded to early on, can Russia change under Putin? And related to that is, can Putin reinvent himself yet again, or is what we're seeing right now Putin's last act, right? Is this his last act, or can he reinvent himself? I have some thoughts on this myself, but I'd actually like to hear. Let's start with Mark. What do you see there?
Well, obviously Russia is changing under Putin, but it's not necessarily changing in the ways that Putin would have liked. So can he reinvent himself? Well, I think this is an interesting
point. Well,
can
the political system change under Putin, I guess, is what I...
And I think the interesting point is, you might say, up to this point, Putin has been in the position of precisely being the actor and then seeing how he can reshape Russian society. Now, I think his capacities to do that are distinctly limited. It's a question of whether Putin can reshape himself and his political system to better match the needs of Russian society. And there, I think it's, you know, distinctly problematic. I can't help feeling it's a little bit like the sort of the Italian Communist Party sort of open letter to the Soviets after 1968, when it was questioning whether or not the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had lost its creative capacities and creative energies. And I can't help wonder if actually Putin still has much in the way of creative capacities or creative energies. And I suspect he's basically tapped out. There are still options, I mean, for him to change, not to become a cuddly liberal figure, of course, but nor necessarily to become a sort of stern neo-Stalinist, as some seem to suggest. I mean, I don't think we're seeing anything like that. I mean, it goes back to my own particular sort of hobby horse of the corruption issue. I do think that is probably one of the very few areas on which there is the potential, I'd say no more than potential, for him to actually reinvent himself in a way that actually still fits with his myth, allows him to align himself more with society. If he turns around and once again becomes the wise but stern czar, who will crack down on the inefficiency and above all corruption of the elite.
Wouldn't that just blow up the whole Putin system? I mean, that all bets are off if he does that, because the whole system is based on corruption.
Yeah, it means declaring a war on your own elite. Right. It's not impossible. It's been done. It's been done in Russian history. And even if one doesn't have to look at Stalin, I mean, in some ways, that's what Gorbachev did. And we know how well that worked. That's what Ivan the Terrible did. And we know how well that worked. I mean, I think this is it. It's not actually as if at all it's an easy option. It's a very dangerous option. It's a very brave option. And it actually would be a very creative option. I don't ultimately think that Putin has
the bravery or the creativity, right?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's funny. If we look at him, you know, the reality of Putin is so at odds with the macho, bare-chested sort of iconography that has been created. On the whole, Putin has not been a brave figure. Putin has been, well, if you're going to be emotive, a bully. You know, he's happy to roll into Georgia. He was happy to annex Crimea and nudge his way into Ukraine because he felt that they were weak and vulnerable. He's not a risk taker. And this would be a serious and major risk. As I said, I ultimately don't think that he's willing to do something the outcome of which would be so uncertain. So the potential is there, but I don't think he's got what it takes. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in that respect, I mean, I think it might well drag out. It might be distinctly Wagnerian in terms of as a final act, with a lot of, you know, very, very loud singing. But, you know, I think we are at the twilight of this god.
Mm. Yeah, Kirill, one of the things that I, when I think of it, is he's kind of crossed a line with the Ukraine crisis. We there's a expression in English, he jumped the shark. It's referenced from the television show Happy Days from the 1970s, if anybody's wondering. But you can Google it. But he jumped the shark with the Crimea annexation, and I don't think there's any going back. I don't think he can reinvent himself. What do you think?
I'd like to go on with the music metaphor which Mark used, but not you know, high culture, but as usual, speaking about
well,
me
jump
with
from
the point.
To happy
yes,
days,
yes, to pop culture. In these terms, you know, Putin looks like you know, aging rock star or pop star who is absolutely exhausted his back catalog. and he just
this was my feeling exact thought watching his yeah. State of the Nation speech yes. actually
yeah his back catalog of his you know in reinventions of his you know tricks of his ideas about nationalism, so everything is exhausted: nationalism, patriotism, struggle with corruption and so on. There are no any you know decent tracks no more in this back catalog, and he has just published his ultimate hit collection, which is all about now he not now but 2 years ago, maybe 1.5 years ago, he reinvented himself for the last time. That was the reinvention of Putin as a dictator. He was not a dictator before mm-hmm. this, and now he is a, you know, 100% dictator in the absolutely ordinary political terms of the second part of 20th century. And that is the end of Putinism as an ideological system. Mm. And there's a political system in some sense. Putin still existing, and maybe he will, you know, he will rule kind of around the country till, you know, till the end of this millennium. I don't know, but
it's a long time. For real. I don't.
But we are speaking about the system, not about the people.
You think the system could remain until the end of the millennium?
Yes, and I think this is the end in this particular sense. I insist that.
Now we've said this before, and it just keeps not being true. This is, we're always accused in this podcast of writing Putin's obituary. And he just
I'm not speaking about the end of Putin himself as a dictator and so on. I'm speaking about the end of the system. Mm-hmm. Putin personally could be a you know ruler of Russia, you know,
until he dies.
Yes,
not the
and
end of
so
the millennium,
on.
Presumably. But
yes, but in this case, there will be, you know, I'm very sorry, but there will be nothing to discuss in our podcast.
Well, this is the thing. Where are we headed to late Brezhnevism? Is what? And it gets funny. Those are the first metaphors that came up when Putin made his decision to return to the presidency back in 2011. And the old Brezhnev metaphors was the first thing to come up, because if he served two more terms, he would have been in power basically longer than Brezhnev. So maybe that's what we're looking at. Any last thoughts before we move on to the second part, Mark? You are indicating you have a last thought.
Yeah, I mean, you know, since you have chosen to drag down my attempt to sort of bring up the cultural base of the podcast, as we've moved from Wagner to Happy Days, I really can't let the opportunity pass by to not bring in the Lord of the Rings also reference, particularly since we've had the abortive attempt to put the Eye of Sauron above Moscow City.
You just made the Twitter really happy, Mark, because there was speculation on the Twitter of whether there would be a Lord of the Rings reference given this, and I kept quiet about it, but Go ahead. You just lit up the Twitter.
I mean, I think the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about Lord of the Rings is, anyway, there are three powers. There is Sauron, the evil dark force. There are the Union of Free Peoples and Gandalf the White, the goodies. And then there's Saruman in the middle, the wizard who flips sides. And in some ways...
The most interesting character.
I was going to say, exactly. For me, the most interesting, because he represents change. He's the one who is reinventing himself. He reinvents the whole orcish people. He stands for a form of an industrial revolution. At a time when actually both sides are really immobile and fixed. Sauron Dark Lord is just the Dark Lord. Nastiness, gloom, flaming eyes. The Union of Free People are just really trying to preserve everything. They have their aristocracies and they're happy, furry-footed hobbit yeomanry, and they don't really want to change
anything
either.
It's like a vegan yoga club.
So, you know, both of the grand antagonists don't want change, except their own... They just simply want to kind of instill their own model on the other, full stop, but with no real evolution. Saruman's the only one who stands for change, and he therefore inevitably gets ground between the tectonic plates of these other two forces. Well, in some ways, I mean, this is actually the situation which Putin would find himself in. Because in a way, he's caught between these sort of two traditional tectonic plates of Russian politics and society, elitism and populism. And, you know, if he did try to change, he would be trying to tap into populism without losing the elitism vote or whatever. Now, that would be an incredibly difficult and complex balancing art. And if even Saruman, even wily Saruman can't do it, I really don't see Putin able to.
Putin as Saruman. Twitter, take note. It happened. Mark just did it. And that's a great way to segue into the second half of our podcast. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the very odd jockeying between Kyiv and Moscow over the fate of the rebel-held areas of eastern Ukraine. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RPRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from London is Kirill Kobudin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Don't believe those who scare you with Russia, who shout that Crimea will be followed by other regions. We don't want to split up Ukraine. We don't need that.
That's Vladimir Putin doing something he doesn't do very often, tell the truth, because it's quickly emerging that Russia doesn't want to take any more territory from Ukraine. It's beginning to appear very much like Russia doesn't want to take any more territory from Ukraine. Their designs are different at this point. In fact, the situation in the Donbas is actually beginning to look a lot like a war that neither side wants to win, or at least a war that both sides wish to lose, but lose the right way. What do I mean by this? Suddenly, Moscow is insisting that the rebel-held areas of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts should remain part of Ukraine. And suddenly, in some ways, Kyiv is acting like it doesn't really want them back. Having failed to get control of all of what it calls Novorossiya, stretching from Kharkiv to Odessa, now they certainly would have loved to have had that, the Kremlin now finds itself saddled with a small, strategically uninteresting, physically devastated, and economically non-viable chunk of that territory. And Russia is making it increasingly clear that it would rather that chunk stay in Ukraine, where it, of course, would be politically destabilizing and economically draining albatross for Kyiv. A report in Nova Gazeta this week, citing Kremlin and rebel sources, indicated that this was now the plan, and it's being executed by none other than our old friend Vladislav Surkov. Now, certainly aware of this, Ukrainian officials although none will ever say this out loud, but I was just in Kyiv, and you get this sense very distinctively. They're beginning to conclude that the best way out of this crisis might be just to cut these rebel-held areas loose. There's actually an interesting debate about this going on in Kyiv, because there's a lot of people that agree with this, but there's a lot of people saying, wait a minute, these are our citizens, this is our territory. But nevertheless, this attitude, it's not spoken, it's not out loud, but it's so this is what I mean by it's looking like a war that both sides want to lose. One person who's willing to say it out loud and frequently is Rutgers University professor Alexander Motil, a regular guest on this podcast, I'm proud to say. I want to quote from a recent article he wrote on the subject. Quote, if Ukraine holds on to the Donbass enclave controlled by Russia, it will revert to its status as a vassal of Russia and have to bear all the costs of the region's reconstruction. Russia, in turn, will require leverage over Ukraine and get away without paying for the destruction she and her proxies caused. Once again, Ukraine will become an impoverished colony, incapable of reform and unable to integrate into the West, while Russia will retain its status as an imperial overlord. In sum, the choice for Ukraine, and politically it's a very painful choice, is between independence, democracy, and Western integration on one hand, and the retention of the Donbass enclave, political decay, and Russian hegemony on the other. Mark, given this, well, first of all, Mark, do you agree with Alexander Motil's assessment here? It's a very interesting take. It's not the first time he's made this argument. Actually, he's been making this argument since before the annexation of Crimea, I might add. But now he's saying it's getting to the point where really it's not just a good idea for Ukraine to let this go. It's almost a matter of survival. First, do you agree? But you do. Whether or not you agree, this paradoxical situation is kind of emerging. So how do you see it?
Yeah, I can't say I do agree. I think that although I can understand the realpolitik rationalization, but like all these realpolitik rationalizations, that kind of rests on an acceptance that ultimately, you know, sort of might is more important than right. Because I think it would be a phenomenally corrosive thing for the founding moment of this new Ukrainian state. And I think, you know, this is it, because actually this is a new Ukraine that we're seeing. If you actually start this new Ukrainian state with the betrayal, with the abandonment of millions of your own people to the sort of bandit hunters of Novorossiya. You know, because we're talking about, let's face it, if you look at the Donbass, it's an area where sure, only 20% of the population are primarily Ukrainian-speaking. But actually, 50% of the population in the most recent polls still identified with themselves as Ukrainian. So what you're more or less saying is, tough luck, actually. Political constraints
but,
for the rest of us.
All of Donbass is unoccupied. All of Donbass isn't occupied. It's a tiny enclave of Donbass. And it's now what is unclear to me, and I'd like to have some hard data on this, is of the people remaining there, how many of them are there because they agree politically with the Novorossiya project and in the Donetsk and Luhansk so-called People's Republics, or is it people that just have been unable to get out? But we're not talking about all of Donbass, and Motil makes this point in his piece. And actually, the more economically dynamic areas of Donbass are actually not occupied by the rebels.
But good luck. I mean, if you do begin to indicate that you're basically going to pull back, good luck in actually sort of holding on to everything that you've got. I mean, actually, it would invigorate. Because let's face it, I mean, I've never thought that Russia wanted further territorial expansion. I've never thought they actually wanted the Donbass. It's always been an instrument to use against Kyiv. Now, precisely because Donbass is not such a great prize in that respect, if it began to look as if Ukraine was thinking in those terms, because it's not something you can just simply do overnight, it actually gives the Russians all the more reason to once again try and push the borders back. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have to take Donbass, you want to make damn sure you've got the best bits of Donbass. So they're not going to accept the booby prize.
This is what
Russians
I mean by both sides want to lose the right way. Basically.
Yeah, but you might say, but if you, as it were, if you're going to, if from Moscow's point of view, if it's going to lose on one level, i.e., it's going to be dumped with the Donbass, it has no reason not to push and at least try to make sure that it gets more of the Donbass, the better bits of the Donbass. And we've seen that they can very, very quickly inject a few thousand troops in. And given the parlous state of the Ukrainian military, you know, 4,000, 5,000, even 10,000 troops makes a massive difference on the battlefield. And quite frankly, they would be able to extend their... Yeah, I mean, they're not going to sort of get Odessa or whatever.
Right.
But again, I think they would have very little incentive not to escalate under those circumstances. Mm. Not escalate in terms of, you know, full war to the knife, but certainly sort of locally. And I also think ultimately... As I said, I mean, we have to realize this is about the creation of a nation, something that hasn't happened for 25 years. You know, this has been one of the great tragedies, you know, that Ukraine has failed to build itself as a state since 1991. So this is the nation-building moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I still cannot help but feel that, yeah, okay, in the short term, it's a lot more convenient to just simply say, oh, no, to hell with it. Let's just sort of abandon these areas. But I think it really would be... politically, psychologically, as well as geopolitically.
I wish we had Alexander to argue with you. But and credit where credit is due, this notion that both sides are trying to lose this war the right way, it came from a conversation I had with Peter Pomerantsev, also another, I'm proud to say, frequent guest on this podcast. But stepping back as to whether this is a good idea or not, this does seem to be coloring this phase of the end game in Donbass, does it not? And doesn't that makes for a very interesting end game, no?
Well, let's hope it's an end game. Again, I mean, I think we have to come back to the fact that this is an asymmetric conflict, not just in terms of, you know, the fighting, but asymmetric in terms of the political intent. Moscow is not interested in Donetsk. Moscow is not interested in Luhansk. Moscow is interested in what goes on in Kiev. So that's not going to go away. Let's say Moscow manages to lose and says, okay, fine, you know, this conflict just isn't working out for us. We're going to extricate ourselves. We're going to just let these people, you know, go down fighting and give Ukraine the booby prize. It's not going to stop wanting to try and put pressure on Kiev. Likewise, though, if Kiev turns around and says, fine, you want Donetsk, you can have the Donetsk. Go away, we're going to build our wall around you and be done. Moscow's not going to say, okay, oops, you know, they outmaneuvered us, end of story. They'll be thinking, okay, well, you know, we have been finessed on this particular battlefront. What's the next battlefront? Moscow's not going to go away. Moscow is going to find alternative ways of putting pressure on Kiev. So it's not going to end the war.
Right.
It will end this particular front of the war, maybe.
Let's push this a little farther then. In each of those scenarios you just laid out, in which scenario does Moscow have more levers to continue to influence Kiev or to pressure Kiev, if you will?
Well, I mean, if Kiev has abandoned Donetsk and Luhansk, then in a way it actually also abandons a certain moral high ground. And it means that basically, precisely because of the sort of funny boundaries that will be created and the continuing interpenetration of Ukrainians and Russian speakers, that it means that Russia can always reactivate if it wants. Russia can think, well, okay, we failed to stir up trouble in Kharkiv this time round. Let's start just putting resources in so that in 6 months' time we can create the Kharkiv People's Republic. You know, I mean, Russia will continue to have those options. So this is what I mean. I think we need a proper resolution. Well, I say we need. Ukraine needs a proper resolution. And, yeah, that will mean some kind of a deal with Moscow.
Mm.
But it won't be a nice – I mean, you know, it's tempting to think of this as a kind of a quick and easy deal that means that no one has to talk to anyone else. That just simply Ukraine backs away and says, that's it, it's done. But, you know, Moscow still has umpteen levers, economic, political and cultural, that it can pull in Ukraine. Kiev needs to unfortunately reach some kind of a wider deal, which will have to be brokered by the Europe and the United States, that allows Moscow to basically feel that at least it can withdraw from this struggle. Not a kind of a clever gambit, but an actual deal.
So you agree? You would disagree with Motil that under that circumstance, that Ukraine would remain essentially, he says, it would remain a colony, if I'm not mistaken. Let me find the exact quote. But it would allow Russia to maintain hegemony over Kyiv.
Well, again, I mean, when you say hegemony, there's active and passive. I mean, in a way, what really at this stage, I think, and again, I mean, this is the point at which actually Moscow has changed attitudes. You know, I think Moscow is now accepting of a rather lower level. I mean, if Kiev were just simply saying, look, we're not going to join, you know, we will guarantee you that over an X period of time, we will not be joining NATO, we will not be joining the European Union. Maybe we'll have some kind of affiliate status with your Eurasian Economic Union, even if we're not going to be full members.
That's unacceptable to the vast majority of the Ukrainian people.
That would
spark another Maidan, in my opinion.
Put it this way: they're not going to join NATO. NATO's not going to let them
talking about them joining. We're talking about them saying that their goal is, if they say we're going to have some association status with the Eurasian Union and we're going to give up our EU integration, that would spark another Maidan.
But the point is, I mean, but the, again,
hey,
the,
we're
the
disagreeing,
the
by
rest.
The way, David Johnson, take note.
We're in a situation in which actually the best favor that Europe could do Ukraine is actually to verbalize what everybody knows. If Europe said, we do not see any prospect that Ukraine can become a member of the European Union for the next 10 years. Mm. So if it came from Europe rather than Kiev, and that's, as I said, that's simply saying what everybody
But it doesn't work because there is no there's a whole procedure for joining the European Union that takes about 10 years, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is a silly point. We're not saying anything new.
And Moscow knows that. But the point is that Ukraine's on that track, on that, if you will, 10-year track or whatever, how many year track it's going to be. It's not fixed in stone. But they're on that track, and that's where Moscow doesn't want them to be, is on that track.
But look, absolutely. Look, Moscow ideally would want Kiev not to even be thinking about European integration. Those days have gone. And I think Moscow appreciates and understands that, even however unwilling it is to accept it. And, you know, again, I think Moscow is – exactly, you're absolutely right on this point. Moscow is tired of this conflict, and particularly it's tired of the continuing risk. Now there's talk of yet further sanctions and so forth. You know, Moscow wants to de-escalate. Giving a 10-year – I mean, I just plucked that figure. But let's say, you know, giving a 10-year guarantee that there's going to be no question of European membership for the next 10 years. As I said, it's not saying anything new, but it allows Moscow to say, we're fine. And realistically speaking, 10 years is beyond the timeline of Putin. 10 years is beyond the pipe. You know, it kicks the problem down the street.
Yeah, I'm just leery of any of these promises of a sovereign state should be able to do what a sovereign state wants to do. In terms of joining whatever it chooses to join. And that's
absolutely, you talk, but the you point talk is, about it something will not be. I mean, it's not saying Kiev will never, ever join the European Union. I mean, that's what Moscow would have ideally liked, but that's not on the table. And frankly, that would be ridiculously inappropriate. Moscow needs its fig leaf.
It needs a face.
Moscow really just wants something that will allow Putin to be able to go on television, whether or not he's wearing a leather jacket, and say, mission accomplished, in classic moment. You know, it's not actually going to be a mission accomplished moment, but he needs to have that. He can't just simply let this peter out. He's put too much personal capital into it. So really, the existing guarantees that are there, that are guaranteed more or less just by practicalities, put them in a box, tie them up with a pretty bow. It actually means nothing to Ukraine in practical terms. It allows Moscow to claim it has had some kind of a victory. That is, it's not so much, I think I would say, that both sides want to lose this war. It's that actually both sides need to be able to claim that they have won this war. And anyway, then Ukraine can simply say, look, we managed to get the Russians to back down. We are now beginning to, although it's going to be, absolutely an expensive and painful process, reconsolidating our grip on, you know, the rebellious regions. Moscow can claim we have protected, you know, because obviously part of this package would also be the existing guarantees that have been made to the Russian language and to the Russians and so forth, and a certain degree of amnesty for lower level people who rebelled, maybe. But Moscow can put all this together and say, this is it. We've saved the people of the Donbass from the neo-fascist pogrom that otherwise would have been facing them. Everyone's happy.
Right. My only problem with that is it's reminiscent of what Czechs call the speaking of the Munich, o nas bez nas, about us without us. And you're basically leaving the Ukrainian people out of this decision, the vast majority of whom do truly want to join Europe. Full stop. And for the
Bless him. I mean, I can understand that. Absolutely. If I were Ukrainian, I would want to join Europe. But it's not going to happen in 10 years.
Right.
So why not just simply
put that in a box with a bow and give it to Moscow is, again, you're risking the Ukrainian street there. You really are. And I know Poroshenko is aware of that.
It would take a hell of a lot of absolutely, it would take a lot of strength. But I'm just amazed that somehow the idea of capitulating chunks of your territory is could somehow at all be regarded as a more palatable solution than just simply recognizing facts on the ground.
Mm. Well, the idea is without this chunk of territory, they could move towards Europe a hell of a lot quicker. That's the essence of Motil's. Kirill, save us. We're disagreeing. It's chaos is breaking out in the podcast.
No. I am not, you know, Gandalf White. But I just a few things. Mark already expressed, you know, the most of my strong disagreement with Professor Motil. I am absolutely sure that this is a very wrong idea. From different points of view. First of all, from the point of view of political philosophy, because political nation is a whole body. You cannot betray a part of your political body, of your nation, in the interest of another one. It's all wrong. Secondly, it's absolutely wrong in legal terms. If modern Ukraine or Kyiv would abandon Donetsk and Lugansk, that will be a sort of precedent, a legal precedent for a further annexation and so on of Ukrainian territory. Don't forget about this. It's absolutely wrong from the ethical or moral point of view, because all these people, including those who are struggling or fighting against Ukrainian army, they're still Ukrainian citizens. So you cannot betray your own citizens because of their bad. Citizenship is not about, being bad or good. And this is a very dangerous thing to divide the nation into, you know, the best Ukrainians or the worst Ukrainians or the real Ukrainians or, you know, fake Ukrainians and so on. And in the future, it will be, you know, just disastrous because Ukraine consists of, you know, various parts with different traditions and so on. And that will be a sort of, ticking bomb under the very foundation of Ukrainian state and society and so on. So I'm totally agree with Mark. It's impossible. I think the most, I'm not giving advice, especially for Ukrainian people and, authorities and so on, but the most, I think, the obvious thing about what to do with all this stuff is just, you know, common sense. Just wait. Just say, you know, direct things about that we are still consider these territories as Ukrainians, including Crimea.
Well, I think that's what's going to happen, and this is going to be frozen. Yeah. This is going to be frozen, but it's going to be de facto.
Yes, but when we speak, you know, from the legal, from the, you know, from the point of view of high political culture, European culture, you are withstanding there, you know, another part of this conflict, Russia, looks like, you know, a bandit. Mm-hmm. We are supporting, you know, high political culture, European culture, legal culture, and whatever, whatnot, yeah, and so on. And the other side, of course, we have to deal with this, with them, because of the circumstances and so on. But from the moral point of view, we are much higher than Moscow. And that is a very good position, including just, you know, common sense. What's we just discussed what's going on in Russian economy, Russian state, and so on. Maybe it's a very good time to wait for something that will happen in Russia.
Well, that the most likely scenario is that these territories are going to be frozen, and that's going to be, and they're going to be de facto out of the body politic of Ukraine. I'm getting the signal from Tanya that we must wrap it up because the time is short and the studio is in demand. So on that note, I will wrap it up. That's all we have time for today, literally. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based History and Sociology magazine, NZ. Thank you, gentlemen, for the enlightening discussion. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Barring any major news in the coming weeks, the Power Vertical podcast will break for the holidays, but we'll be back in action on January 9th. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.